I wanted to say, by the way, about the awards, that it's currently on the ballot. It's shortlisted, as they say over there, for the Arthur C. Clarke Award, which is given by a jury in England for the best science fiction novel of the year.
Uh-huh.
And then also for the British Science Fiction Award, which is a kind of a popular fan award over there.
So your book came out so early that, now, when will you learn anything?
I guess I learn next week about the Clarke Award.
And, oh, really?
Yeah.
Listen, would you do me a favor and let me know one way or the other?
Sure.
Call me, collect. You've got the various... Or have I given you my phone numbers?
Well, I have... I do have... I have one that I got from my publicist to leave that message on your answer.
Yeah, okay. Well, let me give you a home phone, too.
I don't want to speak too specifically because I don't want to jinx it, but I think it's got a fair chance for that one. And that's supposed to be the 25th when they... A week from tonight, they... They have a wonderful method. The jury is like six people. They meet in a pub in London.
Now, this is the Arthur C. Clarke?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they hammer out in an afternoon session who they're going to give the book to. They hold a cocktail party at the end of that session in which they announce it, and they have a two-hour cocktail party, and then everyone goes home.
And then you are invited to this in the meantime?
Well, if I were in England, I would certainly go, and the other candidates are all in England, and they're certainly all going to be there. But since they only decided an hour before they give it out, there's no way of warning a winner ahead of time that they ought to come to the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So my editor in England suggested that it's not worth coming over just on the chance that I win.
I see.
And it's only just a Thursday evening thing. Mm-hmm. Now, the British Science Fiction Award is given out at a convention over there, which would be a whole weekend and be an entire party, and I'm quite tempted to go. But I probably won't.
Uh-huh. Do you ever find yourself in New York?
I go to New York fairly frequently, which is, say, like, now that I'm out here, I go maybe once a year.
Oh, okay.
Talk to my editor and publicist.
Yeah. Now, before I forget, I wanted to get the dates of these annual, the Case for Mars things.
Yeah.
When's the next one?
Colorado, and I think it's like May 22nd or May 30th. In any case, it's a week-long thing in May this year.
And you'll be out there this year?
I heard that there's trouble with the Case for Mars conference with its Boulder setting and that it might possibly be transferred to Stanford. In which case, I will be attending it for sure.
Yeah.
If it's in Boulder, I probably won't go this year. The John W. Campbell Award is given out there at the University of Kansas.
Yeah, and I'm really sorry. I didn't know what was going on to go over there and meet you then.
Well, I suppose that Red Mars is eligible this year because they include British books as well as American.
Well, that's very interesting. I'll call Jim. I teach over there, and I'll get in touch with him and find out what's what.
Yeah, if it's eligible, I would suppose that it would be a possible candidate. I'm not all that aware of what was published last year, and so I don't know what it's potential competition is.
Now, when you came to see him, you alluded to the fact that there had been a visit earlier. What were the circumstances of that visit?
A novel I published in 1990 won the Campbell Award called Pacific Edge.
Pacific Edge.
Yeah.
Okay. And while we're at it, what are some of the other awards for any of your other titles, I should know?
Let's see. The Campbell Award for Pacific Edge, and then I won a Nebula Award for a novella called The Blind Geometer.
Geometer?
Yeah.
Okay.
And
I've got a lot of reading ahead of me.
Yeah, those are really the most significant awards.
Okay. Now, obviously, I can't let you go without asking you to share some thoughts about all these rumblings I'm hearing now about people wanting to get rid of the space station and the Mars shot. I mean, boy, we at first opportunity, people want to scuttle these things, don't they?
Yeah. I think that a lot of this is the fault of NASA being a very disorganized and goalless and rudderless organization.
Yeah.
And they have set the stage for their own failure by not properly defining what they really want to do with these things. And I think the space station is a little bit of an amorphous project and is not strictly necessary for getting to Mars, and in fact is a sort of a expensive slowing down stage along the way. And I know there's a lot of these scientists and engineers in the aerospace industry who are very frustrated by NASA because they all have these innovative and much cheaper plans that NASA just isn't willing to entertain. And it's sort of a monopoly where if NASA isn't interested, you can't get anyone else to be interested.
Now, what is the latest with a manned expedition?
No, I think that it's so far down the pipeline that it isn't even being talked about.
Hmm.
The Japanese are working on this stuff. I have the feeling that they might be a driving force in this. There's a construction company in Japan that feels like there's going to be construction projects to be done on the moon and on Mars, and they've designed a Martian town in detail.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't know about this when I was writing my book, but I was filmed for a BBC program on the terraforming of Mars that was shown over in England last month called Horizon, which is sort of their equivalent of NOVA.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an hour-long program on the terraforming of Mars where they talked to me at the beginning and end of the program and spent the rest of the time talking to scientists. And this Japanese construction company just took the filming crew right out to a little model they have of their Martian village, which is designed and engineered down to the last detail.
I'll be darned.
Japan has got, you know, I think a healthier economy, and maybe there might be some international cooperation going on here, somewhat like I speculated about in the book.
Uh-huh.
The Russians have a tremendous amount of expertise in long-term time and space, and we have NASA's expertise, and Japanese have a lot of money and all this engineering work gone into it. So, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, gee, I guess we've kind of talked through a lot of stuff. Was there something I forgot to ask or was too dumb to ask you about that you really wanted to address regarding the book?
I can't think of anything, really. It's selling well. It's been selling well in England and Australia since last fall, and it's gone into multiple printings and so on and so forth. And it's that the trade paperback here in the United States has just gone into its third printing.
Mm-hmm. Have you by chance been the subject of any documentaries that we might see on television or
no.
public TV?
No. Only that BBC thing was the only thing that I've, you know, had to do with the TV.
Are we coming up on any kind of an anniversary that marks some particular event in our awareness of Mars? Is that you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
1,000th anniversary of whoever looked through the first telescope at it, or heaven knows what. When were the Lowell?
What we're coming on is, in terms of any real anniversaries, is the 100th anniversary of Wells's The War of the Worlds.
Oh, that's true.
Which is still maybe 6 years away.
Sure.
If I recall correctly.
Yeah.
But it's that whole generation of Schiaparelli and Lowell and Wells and Lossitz and Bogdanov, all these people who got good enough view through the telescope to go with this notion of a dying civilization up there with their canal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we're probably about 100 years from when someone translated Schiaparelli with the word canal and set off this huge boom.
Ah, I see. Okay. Well, Stan, this has been a real hoot. I really appreciate you've taken a lot of time to talk with me. I appreciate it.
Fun way to spend an evening. Tell me what's going to be the upshot of this. I never did get a clear sense from Christian what...
Okay. Well, the most immediate thing is this magazine called The World and I.
Mm-hmm.
It's the one I told you that I've done profiles on of Peter Straub and Bradbury. And in fact, I could send you some of that stuff if you'd like to see some of the Straub piece. I'm very proud of. It was
Have you got my address?
Let me see. You know, I don't believe I do. If I could have that, that'd be nice.
Yeah, let me give you the address.
Let me turn this. Go ahead and give it to me, and I'll have it on the tape.
Okay, it's 2414 Endil, which is Elendil, and that's Davis, California.
Now 2414.
Yep.
I'm sorry, I dropped the pen. 2414 what?
Elendil, Elendil. I live in a neighborhood where all the streets are named out of the Tolkien.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a kind of a... ex-hippie commune utopian neighborhood. It's quite wonderful.
Okay, Davis, California.
Yep, 95616.
95616. So anyway, yeah, that magazine is going to be doing something.
Great.
I'm talking to the book review people, a woman named Cynthia Hansen over at the Christian Science Monitor.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a number of pieces for them over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of tough because they have their own book review types who write for them, staff people.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always trying to slip between the cracks with things that maybe they might not be covering.
Gotcha.
And whether or not I can do anything on this over the radio or not, I'm not sure. I'm going to see what kind of sound quality I have.
Right.
Sometimes I do work for Monitor Radio out of Boston, and they are not all that hot about telephone sound.
Exactly.
Sometimes they can clean it up a little bit, and the technology's getting pretty good.
Right.
But if they do decide to go with this, what I might end up doing is they'll send somebody out to see you.
Mm-hmm.
Who would record your end of the conversation as I talk with you.
Right.
Which sounds a little hairy, but it's actually kind of fun.
When did I do that?
Yeah.
Oh, I was on a Canadian television show called Prisoners of Gravity, which is about science fiction out of
China. Oh, that's a nice title.
Yeah, oh, it's a wonderful program. They're actually extremely knowledgeable, and they do all kinds of innovative things to try to make it less than just a talking head TV show.
Yeah.
Or more than.
Huh.
And so I had a video crew here, and I was talking to the guy on the telephone.
Yeah, how about that?
Recording me in a different.
I would think as a writer, you would probably welcome any excuse to get away from the processor or typewriter, huh?
Well, and most of the time, although my British publishers have just, they've been enormously supportive. They published Red Mars as a general fiction lead title over there, HarperCollins, which is one of the reasons I think it got such a big response in England. And they want to publish this next Mars novel in August, and they say that if I give them the book in May, they can publish it in August, which is like a miracle.
Wow, that is. That's amazing. So what
They're real high-tech. I mean, they take the book on disc rather than by manuscript, and they just are very much cutting-edge technology.
That puts a lot of pressure on you, I assume.
Yeah.
Sounds like maybe that's a good one I should leave on.
Well, I'm hustling to try to get it done, and I may not, but this spring is definitely being devoted with my face to the screen.
Yeah. Well, I hope that you dedicate the next one to Frank and John, wherever they are.
Yes, God. I tell you, I miss Frank in the worst kind of way because there was something about his character that mm-hmm. I like rereading his sections, especially that the second one, Chapter 6. As much as anything in that book, and there's something about his kind of angry, acerbic point of view that is unlike any of the rest.
Yeah, and yet he's so effective, really, or at least he's really trying to balance and juggle a lot of things. He's a master politician in many ways.
Yes, and a good politician is a great point of view character.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to substitute as best I can, but I miss those guys.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Okay.
Well, they say that they're, in many ways, when these stories, you know, at some point it's as if they're being telephoned in to me, and I don't feel that I have a whole lot of choice. I mean, just because I personally didn't want him to die didn't mean that it wasn't what happened. You know, I didn't feel like I have a lot of leeway there. And that's, I mean, it may sound mystical, but it's just a point at which the story gets out of your personal.
Well, it seems to be the mark of the real writer that those kinds of things do happen.
Mm. Well, it certainly happens to me.
So, and it's happening for the readers, too. I thoroughly enjoyed the book. It really came alive for me as well.
Oh, good.
So it's been a pleasure, and we'll be keeping in touch. And if you would let me know if and when some of those awards come through, I'd like to add that on, of course.
And I will probably give you a buzz next Thursday. And
okay.
I don't know about the British Science Fiction Award. That's sometime in April, but I don't know when.
All right.
Next Thursday is the only thing I can say for sure. And I probably will be too bummed to call you if I don't get it.
Well,
don't hear from me, you'll know what happened.
Okay, and while I think about it, too, if you happen to have a publicity photo,
mm-hmm.
especially if it's in color, the magazine likes to use color, and if not, that's okay,
mm-hmm.
That you could send me, or I could give you the address of the magazine, whichever you prefer.
Well, you tell me which, and I don't have your address yet anyway.
Okay, well, let's do that.
Okay.
First, the name is spelled like Lawrence Tibbett, but with an S on the end, if that makes any sense.
T-I-B-B-E-T-T-S?
E-T-T-S, yeah.
E-T-S.
Two T's.
Yeah.
6024 Maple. Maple Avenue, Mission, Kansas, suburb of Kansas City.
Mission, Kansas?
Yeah, like Shawnee Mission or Indian Mission. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mission, Kansas, 66202.
66202.
Mm-hmm. And let's make a deal right now. When Green Mars comes out,
mm-hmm.
I'll hope that I can get an autographed copy, and when my book on Dvorak in America comes out, I'll send you one.
Hey, that's wonderful. You're right about Dvorak, huh?
Yeah, it's called Dvorak in America, and it comes out the 1st of June.
Oh, I'm a big fan of his string quartet.
Oh, good. Well, you know the F major quartet that he wrote in America then.
Mm-hmm. With all of the folk tune.
Oh, yeah. And if you like that, in case you aren't aware of it, the string quintet that he wrote at the same time, Opus 97, is even better.
Yes. Oh, yes. I'm a fan of chamber music, you know, after Beethoven's late quartets, amongst my favorites are mm-hmm. Dvorak's.
Well,
they have this muscularity to them that
indeed.
I really admire.
Well, and he was a good man, too. He was one of the good guys.
Image of him, which may not be correct, but if it's false, I don't want you to disabuse me. But I once read that he was a big family man and wrote a lot of his music at the kitchen table with kids and cats crawling all over his head, and that in general it was a life of chaos. And since my own life resembles that in some senses, I've always used him as an image of the artist managing to get good work done in the midst of, you know, domestic madness. So.
Well, let me add an even more felicitous touch to that image, which is true as far as it goes, but he also had many, many pigeons flying through the air. He was a bird enthusiast. In fact, sometimes I think besides his family and music, the two things he loved most in life were birds and locomotives.
Oh, what a silly guy.
So there were a guy named Harry Burley, a young black man who was his secretary and friend in New York, has left some marvelous images of him at the keyboard singing black spirituals to Dvorak while all these damn pigeons were fluttering around the room because he would let them fly free.
Great. Well, so your book will come out in June?
Yeah, and it's a chronicle of the 3 years that he spent here and where he went and what he wrote and who he taught and to what effect.
Great.
You know, Duke Ellington and Harold Arlen are direct descendants of his teachings because his students, in turn, became their teachers.
Oh, well, I will look forward to this.
Yeah, well, I'll send you a little flyer on the thing because if you're a music enthusiast, I'm delighted to hear it. I think you'll find the book interesting.
Yeah, and so that's how you knew Ken Holzman, I mean, with the Berlioz.
Yeah, well, I'd done I've been working on a radio series on Berlioz for some time, and I was reviewing a new book about Berlioz by John Bloom.
Ah.
And Kern, of course, is one of the central authorities in this country.
Right.
Berlioz is always such a hoot.
Yeah, Kern, I'm sorry. I thought it was, I mistook his name.
Yeah. And
when we lived, Lisa, my wife and I lived in Zurich, and Zurich had its 2000th anniversary when we were there.
Which wow.
Was 1986. And so the Tonhalle Orchestra played the Symphonie Fantastique in the Tonhalle, which only holds about 1,000 people. And so they had an array of amplifiers out on the lake, on Lake Zurich.
Oh, my goodness.
That were the hugest things. They were about the size of houses. And so they played Symphonie Fantastique to the entire city of Zurich at a volume that you could not even imagine. It was really quite, I mean, it was very romantic. I'm sure Berlioz was...
Oh, he would have loved it.
He's grooving, yeah.
He would have probably fired a cannon somewhere to
anyway,
punctuate the thing.
That's almost the only connection I have with his music.
He wrote a marvelous essay once about a forester who'd go out into the forest and he would carry a kind of a harp with him.
Uh-huh.
And he would serenade the hills, and when he came to the cadence, he'd fire off his rifle to sort of punctuate.
Yes. I have some of his writing because of the Jacques Berzoun
sure.
collection of...
Well, you know, the Evenings with the Orchestra is absolutely... In fact, talk about utopian writings.
Mm-hmm.
Berlioz had a whole musical city involved called Euphonia.
Oh.
It's straight science fiction. I mean, it's a wonderful science fiction tale about a future country in which the whole community is given over to music, And it reads at times a little bit like something out of the 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T or out of one of those early Disney silly symphonies where you've got huge musical instruments and electronic gadgets and flying machines and a whole city that's turned totally over to music making.
Wow.
It's a bizarre story. It's wonderful.
If this is an interest of yours, which I didn't know, one of my earliest science fiction novels to be published is called The Memory of Whiteness.
Yeah.
And it's out of print right now, so it isn't for sale in new bookstores. But if you can find a copy, it's basically the same sort of notion, except expanded through the solar system.
I want to see this.
It's a future classical music concert tour that goes from Pluto down to the sun, stopping at every planet along the way, and music is the only language that everybody has in common.
Sure.
It's the lingua franca of this exploded solar system civilization. And it's a very strange, it's a kind of a romanticist, you know, fantasia of a novel. It's almost more of a I don't even know how to call it. But in any case, it exists. And if you're interested in music, which obviously you are, I think the people who are interested in music don't get enough science fiction that it talks about it.
Good point.
That's right.
Good point.
I remember a great short story by Berlioz about Beethoven. Oh, no. Either him or maybe it was Wagner.
Now, Wagner wrote several things about Beethoven.
Yeah, a sort of a visit to the ages.
Yes, right.
Well,
Schumann, of course, you're getting into another wonderfully fanciful writer who had music as a central subject in his own works. If you know the whole Florestan-Eusebius dichotomy that Schumann had.
Yes, a very interesting kind of division of the one person.
Right. There'd be dialogues not only in the critiques in which both characters appear, but in the music.
Yes.
You find these dialogues, and then there's this third character who arbitrates between the two.
Oh, now that I didn't know about.
Yeah, Master Raro. And it's R-A-R-O. When you take Clara and Robert and put the two words together, you've got Clara, R-A, Robert, R-O.
Uh-huh.
Now, Schumann never explained that, but it's obvious that that's where the term comes from. And this guy arbitrates between the two. And in the music, there's many episodes where it's bizarre. There'll be a third stave in the piano score with a melodic line in which Schumann marks not to be played.
Oh, my God.
That exists between the left and right hand, so to speak.
Oh, my God.
And it's the only composer I know of that's ever done this, where the music is inscribed there, but it's also marked not to be played. And indeed, I've talked to several pianists like Anton Querti up in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
Who say that it's impossible to play it. But we did an experiment when I interviewed him where with multiple track recording, he played the middle line, and then we mixed it in with the two lines that can be played. And, you know, I'm working on a radio series on Schumann, and we spent a whole episode tracking that kind of stuff.
How did it sound?
It's wonderful.
Oh,
I mean, to most people it would be totally irrelevant, but it was fun for us to mess around with.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's a wonderful thing.
So you got to like a composer like this who writes silent music.
You have to.
In the sense of it being truly silent.
If it weren't for his sad end, it would be even more inspiring, but you have to wonder how pathological it was given what eventually happened to him.
Yeah, I have to confess it was overwhelming to me. I go to these Dusseldorf Schumann festivals every third year. I've been doing so for a decade now. And to go to Endenich, where he died, and to be in the room and look through the window at what he saw and where Brahms came.
Right.
It's a pretty overwhelming experience. This is a composer that's difficult not to deal with emotionally.
Yes, I know what you mean.
And
when I was in Rome as a young man, I sort of accidentally walked into the Keats Museum, which is in the apartment that he died in. And they have his death mask there, and it's effective.
Yeah, that's got to be, what, 26?
Yeah, 25.
Well, by your leave, if it doesn't distract you too much from your writing, why don't I send you off a couple of these things on these subjects that I've written? I'd love to share some things with you.
Oh, that'd be fantastic. I'm a big, as you can tell, I'm really interested in this. And I listen to Schumann a lot, especially in this variations on the slow movement of Beethoven's Seventh.
Oh, my God, you know about those.
Well, you know, Cyprian Katsaras.
Yes, I've interviewed him about that.
These Beethoven symphonies as in the Liszt transcriptions. and yeah. they're really wonderful.
Right.
And one of them, and well, the one of the Seventh Symphony has the Schumann piece as the extra added track on
mm-hmm.
the piece. And that's beautiful music. I mean,
well, Paul Badura Skoda helped unearth that thing, and I've got his recording of it, which was the world premiere. And he's shared some interesting things about tracking that down. There's now several recordings out of a Schumann piano quartet that he wrote as a student.
Wow.
It's marvelous, and it was never published.
Well, he was a, you know, my mom was a piano teacher, so I've heard Schumann. Schumann more than most mortals.
Well, what you've got to hear, if you haven't already heard them, I always urge this on enthusiasts, is the variations on a theme of, or not the variations, the impromptus on a theme of Clara Wieck, but the first version. There were two versions. A second version he revised late in the 30s, early 40s, and he tamed it down. But the Clara Wieck impromptus that came out around 1836, in their original version, are startling. I mean, this was a guy way ahead of the game, harmonically and rhythmically.
Right.
And Charles Rosen has done the recording of the original version, and I spoke with him in New York once about all this. This guy is an amazing guy.
Mm-hmm.
Rosen is a polymath of the first order, and he talks about these impromptus, and they, my God, this is one of the most forward-looking pieces of music I've ever seen, rivaling something like the Symphony Fantastique in a relative sense, you know.
Now, was this recorded in the sense that it was...
Nonesuch. Yeah, he recorded, Rosen recorded these on the Nonesuch label. It's called the Revolutionary Schumann.
Oh, okay.
And you can match it with the later set that Jörg Demus has recorded, and the differences are startling, and it's really a shame that Schumann, in his more conservative phase, tamed it. It's a little bit like reading, I'll tell you what it's like. It's like reading the Henry James New York edition of any of his books.
Yeah.
Without knowing that you can go back and read the original versions of these books, like Roderick Hudson, some of these, and find out how wonderful they are.
Yeah, before
he screwed them up in the New York edition. It's good to go back to those originals.
Writers ought to be banned from going back like that.
Oh, but it must be a temptation.
It is. There's a couple books I think I could really rescue. And in fact, The Memory of Whiteness is one of them. But
yeah.
I think that the young writer has to be given their own chance, you know. And if that's what I thought that I needed to do back then, then...
Well, Bradbury himself has done this. I mean, people should avoid at all costs the October Country. And instead read only Dark Carnival, because what he did to some of those stories in Dark Carnival is tragic.
Yeah.
Just became rhetorically florid, and you know, his Bradbury's later stuff I find almost unreadable.
Yeah.
But the first Dark Carnival is as clean as a whistle. I mean, the stuff is just so spare and biting and precise.
Well,
I'm grateful that they're there, but I wish he hadn't messed around with them later.
Yeah, it's probably a temptation to be avoided, and I must say that if I was going to ever do it, I think I would work in the opposite direction and actually prune back, which might be less damaging.
At the same time, it must be startling. I had a strange moment when I was talking with Straub about Houses Without Doors, which I think is one of the major short story collections in fantasy of the last 10 years. And one of the stories in it, I was going on and on about how wonderful it was, and on. Straub says, I wrote that when I was about 22 years old.
Wow.
There's this long pause, and I could just hear the wheels turning in his head, like, my God, these readers like so much better the stuff I wrote when I was a kid.
Mm.
Ew.
Yeah.
That was a strange moment. But hey, good stuff is good stuff whenever you write it, right?
Yes, I think you have to, you have to just accept all that stuff as a gift and let people like what they like.
Now, I'll leave you with something that's going to tantalize you. Since you like Dvorak, getting back to that just to close out here, did you know that he wrote a cantata called The American Flag?
No.
Yeah, you got to hear that.
Is that recorded?
Yeah, it's like Antal Doradi has done it. It's like a character in Martin Chuzzlewit, you know, the American episodes in Martin Chuzzlewit, when you've got all those windy American orators.
Yeah.
It's like one of them wrote a text about the American flag unleashed and the American eagle surmounting the globe. It's like somebody took a text like that and then gave it to Dvorak and said, run with this.
Now, you say Doradi, does that mean it's piano music?
No, it's Antal Doradi.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, he's conducted it, and so is Tilson Thomas.
Oh, I see.
So Dvorak took this absurd text and wrote this really barn-burning piece of music while he was in New York.
I will look for it.
Oh, I'd be happy to send you a recording of it sometime on tape. It's really something else.
I love it. I'll look forward to it.
Nice to meet another Dvorak enthusiast. Well, anyway, I'll let you go.
Well, hopefully something will bring me to Kansas or we'll have to stay in touch so that when we cross paths, we know it.
And I come out to L.A. periodically, and Davis is just, 40 minutes away by plane. I'd really love to meet you sometime.
Well, it will certainly happen because it sounds like we both have, movable jobs.
I think so. Okay. Well, Stan, you take care.
Okay, and thanks for everything. I really appreciate you getting the word out on this book.
Oh, you bet. Well, it's a pleasure, real pleasure.
All right.
Okay, you take care now.
All right. Good night.
Bye-bye.